you think we should collect?
Fairchild answered that he had studied crop diseases for American farmers. But nothing on the other side of the world could solve the problem of a pear grower in Minnesota. While he enjoyed the exotic allure of the Indian Ocean, he didn't feel that he was helping farmers in need back home. Lathrop sat and listened. Fairchild continued by describing the World's Fair and the type of farmers who came to see his pear blight demonstrations. They were provincial and distressed, far too preoccupied with the problems in their fields to care about the novelties of a faraway land. Biologists could help them, perhaps by finding foreign predators of the pests on their farms. But that kind of work was targeted and deliberate, not accidental and haphazard. At a pause in Fairchild's monologue, a Catholic priest appeared in the doorway. He'd heard there was a botanist on board. Fairchild, a little flummoxed, invited him to sit. The priest, unaware of the tension in the room, described a vast collection of orchids he kept. He explained how he had built a garden of his own with new plants and rare flowers. The minutes turned into several hours as the man described the wonders that plants held, and how people living in subtropical places like North America or Europe were oblivious to the wondrous diversity of the earth. The priest bored Lathrop, but he also gave Lathrop an idea. After the man left, Lathrop asked Fairchild if he remembered his first taste of a banana. What about a grapefruit, or even a durian? The answer was obviously yes. For a botanist, the first taste of a new plant was like meeting a new person, and recalling it flooded the mind with memories of where it had happened, what the tongue had expected, and what it found instead. Lathrop explained that the sweet flavor and starchy texture of a banana was easy to remember because it had been new. A man as traveled as Lathrop knew there were thousands of wild plants around the world, perhaps millions, that farmers had never seen. If I was a botanist with the opportunity to travel, I'd collect native vegetables and fruits. There are drug plants that can help cure ailments and all types of other useful plants still unknown in America. Fairchild's citron adventure in Corsica was, at the moment, the best example. Lathrop seemed to be conjuring that episode to explain that it could be done repeatedly and for more crops. Crops farmers had asked for, and many more that they hadn't. Lathrop stood up and mounted to his grand proclamation. As a botanist, you can help farmers solve problems with their current crops, or you can bring them new crops, the seeds to start rival industries. The idea was steeped in history. It also carried the sort of American ambition common in the 1890s. Lathrop was suggesting that the key to their future success was in botany, and specifically foreign crops of economic value. For most of America's 100-year life, agriculture had been for subsistence, or, in the case of the Western states, for setting roots on the lands of native people. In the early 19th century, several major land deals had extended America's waistline. The biggest, the 1803 purchase from France, added almost 1 million square miles of its Louisiana territory, a bargain for just $11 million. The United States got even luckier in 1848 when Mexico ceded its sleepy 155,000 square mile California territory to its northern neighbor, along with enough land to make the modern states of Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming. Just over 7,000 Spanish people lived in the California Territory, and even fewer in the other future states, so it wasn't a large loss. Except that 9 days before the agreement was signed, a New Jersey carpenter found gold in a California creek bed. Despite his tiptoeing, the find became international news. The rush for gold subsided with time, but after that, the bigger claim to fame for the fertile and well-watered slice of land beside the Pacific would become its discovery as one of the most agriculturally productive pieces of earth. In the tense days before the Civil War, Congress started discussing a large-scale giveaway of land to the people, both for economic growth and to make sure that America's new land stayed American. Under the Homestead Acts, anyone, except those who had ever fought against America, could apply for 160 acres, so long as they committed to live on it. And, came the implication, to defend it from Indians. The only other catch was that recipients had to occupy the land for 5 years before they owned it, which, to most people pursuing a new life in the West, didn't seem like a catch at all. After the war ended in 1865, even former slaves were eligible for land, and not long after, Native Americans, too, the tracts given to families in an attempt to dismantle large tribes and reservations. Over the next 30 years, the government granted 2 million claims. 10% of all government property was given to first-time landowners, many who had no choice what to do with the land but to farm it. The result was a flood of wheat, beef, and citrus that was sent east in such volume that supply eclipsed demand. In 1893, the same year that the world looked to the Chicago World's Fair for demonstrations of America's bright days ahead, the United States entered its first agricultural depression. Producing food had become a business rather than a way of survival. Farmers needed to become competitive. That competition didn't make for agricultural diversity. Attempting to grow new crops to outmaneuver your neighbor is simply too risky in farming, where uncertain environmental factors favor the familiar over the unknown. In the early 1880s, Joseph L. Budd, an American eulogized as the highest authority on horticultural subjects in this country, had tried to import apple varieties from Russia. The plan might have worked if not for the lack of a central authority to act as a seed bank and help farmers troubleshoot, an authority like the Department of Agriculture or one of the land-grant colleges. Waves of blight had killed early apples, and America's humidity was stressful to Russian trees. What's more, apple reproduction is extremely heterozygous, with two parents that produce unpredictable offspring, much like humans, meaning the only way to guarantee consistent fruit is to clone a tree. Farmers who had spent their lives tending corn or cotton were largely oblivious about apples, so the novel fruit from a foreign land was neglected to death. Lathrop believed that he and Fairchild were in a position to know better, not just about apples, but about thousands of other crops too. Traveling gave them a view of rare fruits, but more than that, a reasonable understanding of growing methods they could relay to farmers back home. The idea held the potential to kickstart a new era of agriculture in America. Bananas could grow in Florida, mangoes in California, avocados perhaps on the rainy shores of the American West. Even the mangosteen, the purple sphere from the Malay Islands, no bigger than a baby's fist, could find fertile soil in the southeast. Fruits that had never grown in North America and had only been tasted by a fortunate few would find opportunity to sprout on new land. The contours of a plan were coming together, but there were still thorny logistics. Anyone who had shipped seeds back to America, as Fairchild had, knew that sending living plant material required someone to receive it. After a long ocean journey, seeds and cuttings would need to be planted quickly, in conditions as similar as possible to their comfortable habitat. Seeds and cuttings from the tropics that arrived in Washington would need to be carried down to South Carolina, or even farther, to Georgia or Florida, both barren lands where few people lived. At the fastest, the journey, start to finish, would take 2 months. And what would happen when the seeds and cuttings arrived? Who would know how to care for them? The motley group of botanists at the Department of Agriculture spent their days researching old crops, not new ones. And the Department of Agriculture had one of the smallest budgets in Washington, reflecting its low regard. Even with Fairchild and Lathrop volunteering, pro bono, to complete the hard work of exploring and selecting, someone back home, likely someone who had never tasted a mangosteen or smelled a rancid durian, would need to complete the process of propagation, distribution, and ultimately, marketing. But the particulars would have to wait for another day. The hour was late, and the world, at the moment, was preoccupied. It was December 31st, 1896. In New York, where the sun was almost at its highest point in the sky, crowds of people began to assemble around Trinity Church at the south end of Broadway, waiting for a set of chimes at midnight. A new year meant a new day ahead, but before that, a raucous night. At the same moment, Fairchild and Lathrop were floating in the dark on a quiet ship somewhere near Singapore. The talk that began in the evening lasted late into the night. Their conclusion was vague, and, in Fairchild's mind, ill-defined. But finally, they had an understanding and a collective vision that seemed to please them both. Drifting in the Indian Ocean, the pair agreed to study plants useful to man, and with one providing the means and the other the brains, finding a way to bring them to America. While they talked, in the middle of the ocean and in the middle of the night, the ship's clock struck 12, and 1897 began. Chapter 5. The Listless Pacific. Lathrop took the last guest room, and so the only room left was the ballroom, wide open and boiling hot. An American named Edison had commercialized a heated glass bulb in 1879, but the technology had only recently come to Bangkok, delighting the hotel's owner so much that he kept his new electric lights on day and night, burning, humming, and radiating heat. After the hotel fell quiet, Fairchild constructed a tower of tables and chairs. He climbed to the top and unscrewed each bulb of the grand chandelier. He found his way down and dismantled his ladder in the dark, then fell asleep to the swishing sounds of cockroaches scurrying along the floor. The early days of a new year brought another revelation for Fairchild and Lathrop. Washington wasn't prepared to receive cuttings of tropical plants, and even if it were, the land around the Chesapeake, which alternated between sweltering and frozen, would be a lousy place to raise plants accustomed to consistent warmth. It dawned on Fairchild first, who had little difficulty convincing Lathrop that their collection expedition would need a tropical home. Looking at a map, one could not have found a more perfect spot than Hawaii. The Pacific archipelago sat conveniently between Asia and North America, and in 1897, the islands were already American territory, if not in law, then in spirit. The United States had become the biggest trading partner for the Kingdom of Hawaii and its most abundant product, sugar. In exchange for the right to export sugar duty-free, Hawaii's monarchy in 1876 had granted the United States a military base at the small southern inlet of Pearl Harbor. Native Hawaiians, who numbered just under 40,000, protested the agreement, fearful that any capitulation would lead to greater American presence. The people were right. United States Marines stifled the protests, and by the end of the century, a group of American civilians had begun living on the middle island, Oahu, home of the Hawaiian capital. In December of 1893, during his second term as president, Grover Cleveland publicly discussed annexing the islands to the United States. It would not have been difficult. His successor, William McKinley, eventually did it. But even the fact that people in Washington were thinking about it effectively opened Hawaii for any business America could dream up. Fairchild and Lathrop agreed that for the next month, they'd hopscotch the South Pacific, stopping on islands as big as Australia and as small as Fiji. They'd survey worthwhile plants and collect cuttings and seeds. But the real goal would be to find them a tropical home. They imagined that in Hawaii they'd convince a landowner to donate soil for an experimental garden. A donation was crucial. Surely Lathrop could have afforded a plot of his own, perhaps an entire island. But an existing landowner was effectively a recipient, a willing addressee to receive packages from around the world and co-conspire in a grand but vague plan of importing foreign plants. The tensions between Lathrop and Fairchild were slowly becoming unkinked, a little every day as each assimilated more to the other's sensibilities. Lathrop's impatient outbursts were becoming less frequent, and Fairchild reminded himself daily to make snappier decisions. Lathrop's style had grown more predictable, and Fairchild began to admire the man's demeanor, even his incessant storytelling. Uncle Barber was a great raconteur, Fairchild observed, of their early days together in the Pacific. His seat was always at the captain's table on shipboard, and at whatever table he sat, there was one continual round of fun and intellectual sparkle. His stories were always on a high level. He never indulged in off-color ones. I recollect how he burned up with sarcasm at a stranger in the smoking room once, who prefaced a story he proposed to tell by saying, "Well, as long as there are no ladies about." He could make his audience listen to him without that low subterfuge. He never discussed such things with me, and he never told or listened to such sex appeal stories. He was, in his time, the world's greatest reformer of those things that had to do with travel, and he would spare no expense and stop at nothing if he thought there were graft or a lie hidden away somewhere in the makeup of anyone he met. If he suspected a steward or a purser of double-dealing, he would hound him out of his position and spare no pains to do it. He considered this a plain duty to society. One of Lathrop's helpful lessons to Fairchild was that peppering someone with questions could yield more plants than if he searched for them blindly. At a dinner party hosted by an American doctor one night in Bangkok, Fairchild passed around the table his name card, on which he had written, "What's the finest fruit in all of Siam?" A scrawled sentence came back to him on a card he'd keep for the rest of his life. "It's the wampi." This launched Fairchild on a quest for a wampi, a small citrus fruit with rough, pale skin that would pass for a yellow grape if it didn't grow on a tree. It took less than 2 hours for him to find a grove and fill his pockets with cuttings, this time resolved not to ask for permission, but, if caught, for clemency. Owing to this strategy, the wampi would one day live in California and Florida, although its botanical sibling, the kumquat, less of a diva about soil and water, would end up with more market share in the United States. In each part of the world he visited, Fairchild wrote to his friends back home, regaling them with stories of Lathrop's peculiarities and inscribing written portraits of the remote locales. In one letter, he described an incomprehensible scene in Bangkok. He witnessed a man fall into a river and then, unable to swim, splash hysterically and beg people on the banks to pull him out. But as Fairchild watched, himself too far to help, every person that was in a position to save the man's life refused. According to the era's Buddhist philosophy, anyone who rescued the man would be responsible for his future behavior, including crimes he might commit. Saving him was too great a risk, and so, after a few minutes, the man drowned. Even in 1897, Sydney was a metropolis of wonder. The entire eastern half of Australia had been parched by a winter drought. But in the spring, buckets of rain turned dust into blankets of foliage, made even brighter in contrast with the deep blue of the harbor. Lathrop and Fairchild landed in Australia aboard a ship operated by North German Lloyd, a line of such luxury it once won Mark Twain's endorsement as the delightfulest way to travel. Their steamer, the Sumatra, had smoking rooms for men and drawing rooms for women, and was so well built that in low water it could scrape the muddy ground and proceed undamaged. This Lathrop knew, but Fairchild did not. When Fairchild shook him one night, panicked that the vibrating ship must be sinking, Lathrop rolled over.
"Pshaw, I don't believe it," Lathrop said, half awake. "We're crossing the bar and the water is a bit low. Go back to your bunk."
Australians had a habit of being short on words. If someone didn't know how to answer a question, they stared straight and walked away. It took considerable time for Fairchild to find his way to a grove of eucalyptus trees, the only species of plant he knew for certain existed on the expanse of land the British had once used to banish prisoners. The trees were bigger than he imagined, almost as tall as the great sequoias of the American West. As he looked up at them, a small lyrebird with the tail of a peacock passed by. Fairchild stopped to gawk at the bird. While Lathrop spent his days reading in the hotel and entertaining guests with stories of his latest life-threatening triumphs, Fairchild explored. He took cuttings from branches of several different species of eucalyptus. There were more than 500. Curious if they'd grow anywhere in the United States. They could provide shade, and in North America, they'd lack natural predators. A man in Australia stared at Fairchild, drawn first to the way he talked. Nathan Cobb was a Yankee, too, and in a far-off corner of the world, it was rare to meet a fellow American. Cobb was a specialist in nematode worms, but he had been lured down under by the newly created Australian Department of Agriculture to figure out how to grow better wheat. Developing governments, especially those like Australia, endowed with money from a foreign crown, had begun to consider growing food more efficiently. As both an American and a scientist, Cobb found Fairchild and Lathrop's plan riveting. He quizzed Fairchild on all the places they had been so far. Then he brought Fairchild into his lab. He presented a small wheel that stood on a wooden stand. The wheel spun horizontally around a kernel of wheat, held in place by a sharp dental pick. A camera took pictures at 8 different angles, which were then printed, cataloged, and studied to help farmers learn to recognize superior varieties. So much was unknown about wheat in those days, and it had never been studied at a scale as small as this. No one knew why, of all the grains on earth, wheat, rye, and oats would make bread, and why other grains, such as rice, corn, and millet, refused to rise. Cobb had dismantled the cell of a grain of wheat. This revealed a protein that helped the dough hold bubbles of carbonic acid that let it increase in size before it was baked. By doing this, Cobb became the first man to identify gluten. It would have been rude not to invite Cobb to dinner, so Fairchild informed Lathrop that the professor would be joining them at their hotel. On special occasions, Australians ate meat pies of mutton, curry, and lamb chops. The three sat with steaming bowls and full glasses, and for once, Fairchild directed the conversation, while Lathrop sat silently and listened. The people of Fiji had never met ice. For most of human history, frozen water had been a contemptible symptom of winter, and it hardly existed near the equator. In the 19th century, a Boston man named Tudor became a millionaire by introducing it to the tropics. But he never made it to Fiji, where cool breezes kept the climate more consistently comfortable than anywhere else on Earth. The first person to bring ice to a group of Fijian warriors was David Fairchild. He carried it from the ship's icebox as a token of goodwill. "Kata kata," the chief yelled, the Fijian word for hot. He dropped the piece of ice, then had to be persuaded to pick it up again. It wasn't hot, he realized, but extremely cold. Someone suggested he put it in his mouth, and when he did, he smiled. He passed the shrinking cube down a line of Fijian men. Each held it on his tongue and then passed it along. Every one of them grinned. Some even giggled. Fiji's nickname, the Cannibal Islands, was given for the most literal reason. Far from a source of shame, eating other humans had become one of the island's many cultural traits. On long stretches at sea, the Polynesians who settled there had turned to eating human flesh out of necessity, which continued when they reached the islands they later named Fiji. Eating human meat became as much a part of being Fijian as making fine pottery or wood carvings. Lose a battle, and your bones would wind up under the victor's home. Upset the king, and you could end up in his stomach. A Fijian defense of cannibalism, the oral history of how it started, and why it continued so much longer than in other early societies, is a rationale largely lost to time. The clearest view of cannibalism comes from Westerners, several of whom visited Fiji during its 19th century heyday, and seemed to take great pleasure in demonizing a culture and its people. Murder is regarded as a gentlemanly accomplishment by them, and no young man is fitted to take his place in society until he has committed at least one homicide, the Sacramento Daily Union reported of Fijians in June of 1875. The wealthy partook most often. Common people received occasional invitations for the scraps from a human head or arms, known as bakolo. Flesh was so sought after that the highest gastronomic praise one could give was to say, "It is as good as bacalao." By this point in history, most cultures had moved on from the practice of eating other humans, except in the most desperate of cases. But not in Fiji, a clear example of how culinary trends are intensely cultural and tied to morality. The running hypothesis at the time, which helped most of the world look at Fiji with resigned disapproval rather than moral outrage, was that cannibalism kept an island society stable. Problems created by a growing population with limited land required a drastic solution. Cannibalism, once a matter of food scarcity, became the culture's way of quelling tension between senior and junior males, both in pursuit of the same few resources, or, more pointedly, women. Alfred St. Johnston, an explorer who visited Fiji in 1883, reported to the world that Fijians really seemed to love the taste of human flesh. It tasted a bit like pork, but was more tender and flavorful, he was told. A man's absolute authority over his wife meant that he could slay and eat her. For ceremonial events, such as the christening of a new canoe, a body would be sacrificed for each new plank, and then more corpses would be needed to roll the canoe to water. It turned into entertainment, Johnston reported. There used to be a regular display of slaughter, in a sort of arena, round which were raised stone seats for the onlookers. In this space was placed a large braining stone, which was used thus. Two strong natives seized the victim, each taking hold of an arm and leg, and lifting him from the ground, they ran with him head foremost, at their utmost speed, against the stone, dashing out his brains, which was fine sport for the spectators. One run at the stone was usually enough, certainly for babies, although several dashes could be made for adults. After skinning the corpse, men filled it with hot stones to cook it evenly. The thumb and palm tended to be the most sought after. There was little risk that Fairchild or Lathrop would meet this fate. Cannibalism had begun to fade as a cultural practice once the British landed on Fiji's shores, bringing with them Christian morality and cultural judgment, effectively introducing the notions of murder, shame, and repentance. By 1890, the practice was nearly wiped out, except for among a few elders who retained their taste for human flesh. But not for Fairchild's. His skin was white, and known to carry unsavory flavors and the chance of disease. Fairchild and Lathrop met the king of one of Fiji's largest tribes on Bau, an island 1,000 feet wide that legend held had been artificially expanded by Fijian women, who dumped baskets of debris onto shallow coral for decades until the island was enlarged. In the confusion of translation, the king was led to believe Lathrop was the president of the United States and Fairchild his personal secretary. The king, whose exposed belly shook as he laughed, was so honored at the audience he ordered several women to prepare a kava ceremony so that his guests could drink the drink that made the mouth tingly and numb. The women joined the circle, their breasts dangling as they chopped roots of the kava vine, and then chewed the roots into fibers. Fairchild's fascination turned to revulsion. "One by one," Fairchild recalled, "the women deposited their quids in the big bowl of water and walked out. The attendant then stirred the mess with his hands and dragged the coconut fibers through, partially straining the liquid." Fairchild dutifully drank. Later he learned that Lathrop poured his ration in the dirt. As the two cruised the Fijian islands in a small launch, wild pigs regularly poached their supplies. Cuttings that Fairchild had taken of wild palms either decayed or disappeared in the blur of fast motion. The collecting part of the expedition had become an afterthought. Until there existed a place to plant them, Fairchild convinced himself that collecting plants didn't need to start in earnest. It took more than 10 days to reach Honolulu. Lathrop had been before, twice. For Fairchild, it was the farthest both east and west he had ever been. The first to discover Hawaii had been Chinese sailors, enchanted by the crisscrossing grain patterns of the island's sandalwood. But Americans and Europeans found a more practical benefit, agriculture, and mostly sugar. This discovery was the beginning of the end for the Hawaiian monarchy, which had lasted just shy of a full century. Queen Liliuokalani, the woman who would be Hawaii's last monarch, had reason not to like the Americans. She tried, with her limited military, to push them away, but the effort backfired. In 1893, a committee of 13 men from America and Europe staged a coup to depose her. They argued that Hawaii wasn't reaching its agricultural potential. But the real reason was that everything about Hawaii, its soil, its weather, its strategic location, would benefit the United States. And unlike the spear-pointing Malays or Filipinos, the Hawaiian people were docile enough for the Americans to overtake. As the rest of the world was fixated on the impending World's Fair in Chicago, the men barricaded Liliuokalani in the Royal Iolani Palace. Not long after, the Kingdom of Hawaii became the Republic of Hawaii, and the first president was Sanford Dole, an American whose snowy beard parted evenly into two white curtains. Dole would govern for the next decade. His cousin, James, would go on to build the largest pineapple company in the world. Fairchild and Lathrop's reception in Hawaii was largely seamless because of the United States incursion. Their goal in Hawaii wasn't to collect, but to find land and a botanically minded baron to receive cuttings. In theory, Lathrop and Fairchild would check on the garden every so often. Or better, someone else from the Department of Agriculture would, someone who could judge the plants and disseminate workable crops to farmers, and by doing so, allow Fairchild and Lathrop to stay in motion. As the boat pulled into Honolulu, Lathrop explained their strategy. They'd visit all of his deep-pocketed friends, who, like Lathrop, might be compelled to participate, less out of enthusiasm than boredom. If they demanded payment, Lathrop would oblige. But the cause would be more than a favor. They were asking on behalf of the United States. The first man they visited was William Brigham, whose bald head and white beard gave him the visage of Charles Darwin. Brigham was a geologist who collected Polynesian artifacts, and he happened to be an oracle of plants. Inside his house, just to the east of Pearl Harbor, Fairchild explained his and Lathrop's plan and fielded Brigham's many questions. How would the seeds get to American farmers? Who would want them? Does the Department of Agriculture even know about this? Fairchild could offer little more than hypotheticals, and once again, a retelling of his exciting work in Corsica. Brigham declined to participate due to his advanced age of 56, but he recommended a friend. The friend Fairchild met later that day was Samuel Damon, a politician. Damon didn't like the idea either. Or perhaps he couldn't be bothered. During a meeting in which he hardly looked up, he explained to Fairchild that he was more interested in tending his orchids than opening up land for other people's benefit. The final person for them to ask lived on a different island, the biggest one and the namesake of the chain, Hawaii. Fairchild took a lengthy ride on a small boat, and again crawled off dizzy and sick, and lay for hours moaning in the shade. He walked to the home of Klaus Spreckels, a German horticulturist who had built great wealth and reputation growing sugar beets in California. He was also the chief force behind the downfall of Hawaii's monarchy. He didn't participate, but he owned enough Hawaiian debt to stretch its leaders impossibly thin. There were 1,000 reasons why Spreckels should have said yes. He had personally benefited from tropical crops, especially sugar. He was eager to learn about new crops that were beginning to appear in Hawaii, rare fruits like avocados and mangoes. Coffee, too, had qualities that seemed to fit Hawaii's climate. But he, like Damon, couldn't be bothered. Other matters of botany interested him more than waiting by the mail for urgent missives from a pair of travelers he hardly knew. Before he left the island, Fairchild procrastinated boarding the small boat to return to Oahu. He tried poi, the flavorless mashed stem of the taro plant. He talked with a man who managed a leper colony on the island of Molokai. He wandered around the beaches, staring toward the endless reach of the horizon. And finally, a small indulgence, Fairchild took a horse-drawn cab to see the volcano of Mauna Loa. It was the largest active volcano on Earth, having erupted nearly every half-decade for the past 3,000 years. Under it bubbled the caldera of magma that built the Hawaiian Islands. While Fairchild stood and scanned the landscape of hardened lava, it struck him that, in comparison, Vesuvius hadn't been that impressive after all. Lathrop didn't speak. There was nothing to say. Securing land from one of several rich men was supposed to be easy, and yet Fairchild had failed. Lathrop's illustrious idea had been crushed by Fairchild's ineptitude, exposing lofty notions of plant exploration as little more than storybook fantasy. Fairchild and Lathrop were given a ceremonial exit from Hawaii, during which they wore shirts of floral patterns and women placed plumeria leis around their necks. An orchestra punctuated the melancholy departure, and as the boat left the harbor, the musicians played the soft, slow notes of Aloha Oi, the Hawaiian song of farewell. Lathrop was eager to get home. He was a man whose joys didn't linger, and neither did his disappointments. He looked only forward, keen to return to the Bohemian Club, where his portrait hung on the wall. He would arrive in time to join the club's summer encampment in its redwood grove north of San Francisco. He had a new batch of stories to tell, all ripe for embellishment. Fairchild, however, saw his star fading. He had quit his job in Washington for Naples. He had left his work in Germany for the dream of Java. And he'd abandoned Java for a fanciful idea that materialized into a poof of air. Arriving in San Francisco, he spent several hapless days with Lathrop, distracted by the early summer sundresses of the West. "I had never beheld so many beautiful and well-dressed girls in all my life as there were that day in San Francisco." Lathrop bid him farewell with the detachment of a father leaving his son for a single day at school. He never said it, but Lathrop's demeanor betrayed his disappointment. "I felt that Mr. Lathrop was at times a bit doubtful about his investment," Fairchild would write. The plan hadn't failed for lack of money, but for lack of follow-through. That was a quality Lathrop never claimed to have, and all he required of his companion. His far-flung travels now over, his ambition sunk, Fairchild boarded a cross-country train with the intention of stopping halfway in Kansas. 3 years had passed since he had last walked American soil, and twice as long since he had seen his parents. After receiving word from their son in faraway Java, they found it hard to imagine he'd ever return. His mother, Charlotte, at first didn't recognize him. George Fairchild greeted his son with the handshake of a fellow man. Their lives had taken dark turns. A decade prior, George had been named president of Kansas State University. Now, a political movement known as populism that brought a fear of establishment and corporate power had not only ejected him from the job, but had driven him and his wife from their house after someone set it on fire. George was stoic, unmoved by his misfortune. He and Charlotte were preparing to move to Kentucky, where George could find new work. After several dinners, where Fairchild recalled stories of the Javanese durian fruit, the real-life cannibals of Fiji, and the idiosyncrasies of Barbara Lathrop, both George and Charlotte urged their son to return to Washington. Kansas wasn't a place for a boy of worldly ambition. They believed if he tried, he could get his old job back and rise through the ranks of government. As the train pulled away from the station, Fairchild smiled, seeing his parents wave at him for what would be the last time. As the steam locomotive picked up speed, he sulked in his seat, confronting the reality that awaited him in the capital. He would arrive in Washington, the city built between two rivers, at the height of humid August. He had only the money in his pocket, no place to live, and most dismaying for an educated man of 28, no job. Part 2. Chapter 6. One Cause, One Country. At the corner of 11th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., was Harvey's Ladies and Gentlemen's Oyster Saloon. The capital city was known for its oysters, and Harvey's was the church of the shellfish. The restaurant was named by a pair of brothers who, following the Civil War, had experimented with ways to cook oysters, steamed, roasted, grilled, or fried, and concluded that steaming in lightly salted water was the superior method. The layout of the joint was as deliberate as the source of the oysters, which arrived daily on overflowing carts from the Chesapeake. The first floor was for men, the second for women, and the third a series of private dining rooms for the well-heeled. The fourth floor wasn't a floor but a facade, so the restaurant wouldn't be shorter than the two adjacent buildings. Every president from Abraham Lincoln to Franklin Roosevelt ate at Harvey's. When David Fairchild returned to Washington in the summer of 1897, it was William McKinley's turn. Whispers that the major was in the building could travel from the third to the first floor faster than the plates of oyster shells down the dumbwaiter. McKinley, soft-spoken and reserved, had been president just 6 months, and his style appeared to be as a deal-making unifier, relenting to meet with anyone, even an enemy, who might be tomorrow's ally. The mystique of the president eating oysters did not last long. People returned to loud conversation, the ambient hum of men in suits, their ties loosened, drowned out by a piano. Back in town, Fairchild spent his first few evenings at Harvey's, regaling his friends with stories of the Pacific. None provoked more interest than his descriptions of the girls in San Francisco in waist-tight dresses. Fairchild's return to Washington wasn't as bleak as he'd expected. Despite being unemployed and homeless, he found the city relaxed and quiet. In less than a week, he ran into an old friend, Walter Swingle, who had grown up on the same plains of Kansas. As boys, the two had been educated together, both taught by Swingle's mother. In the afternoons when Swingle would help his father, a farmer, cut wood or drive cattle home from pasture, Fairchild sometimes tagged along. Those dirty fingernail afternoons were a respite from the life with his strict, academic father. They were also his first introduction to the physical work, not just the theory, of farming. As they grew older, Swingle and Fairchild had followed nearly the same path. Both studied botany at agricultural universities before securing jobs at experiment stations for the Department of Agriculture. Fairchild, 2 years older than his friend, had recommended Swingle for the job, and Swingle's parents, on account of their son being too young, had had to give special assurance that Walter could handle the work. The irony now was that Swingle still had a job, and Fairchild did not. Swingle loved hearing Fairchild's stories, particularly about Barbara Lathrop. He had never met the man whose description defied belief, but he enjoyed the caricature Fairchild drew with quotes and impressions. Fairchild would critique Swingle's mustache, clothes, and manners with Lathropian disdain. Twice in the past 4 years, Lathrop had surprised Fairchild unannounced, once in Naples and the other time in Java. So one night at Harvey's, Swingle, feeling prankish, paid a waiter to deliver 3 glasses to the table. One of them, he said, for a Mr. Lathrop, who would be joining them shortly. Swingle laughed as Fairchild fell pale. Fairchild and Swingle found a boarding house on California Street Northwest, each renting a room from an old man who let only to young men. In the late days of 1897, Fairchild and Swingle managed to occupy the top floor. They discussed their travels and their futures late into the night. Swingle, who had studied in the classical laboratories of Bonn and Leipzig, was fascinated by the erstwhile plan Fairchild and Lathrop formulated in the Indian Ocean. It made sense. America needed new crops. Swingle had believed, for years, even as a teenager, that agriculture was a potent source for economic growth. After an 1891 trip to Florida, Swingle developed what would become a lifelong obsession with citrus. That year, at just 20, he told a roomful of Florida citrusmen that a young man traveling around the world, especially to Asia, could yield incredible new varieties. Hell, even he'd be willing, and on a shoestring, just with his expenses paid. But his proposal was roundly dismissed. Travel was expensive, inefficient, and uncomfortable. Anyone who would want the job wouldn't be qualified. And all that time and energy, for what? The plan lacked guarantees that it would yield anything useful. But sitting in front of Swingle was his friend who had actually brought the ambition to life, or at least had come closer than anyone else. Fairchild had spent several months acting as the kind of explorer Swingle had once imagined. Fairchild, for his part, seemed to revel in this elevation of his expertise. Travel with Lathrop had given him confidence and poise. In America's gilded capital, he found himself more knowledgeable about agriculture than anyone in town. If anyone was qualified for this type of work, he was. Inspired by the possibilities, Swingle envisioned the two of them, and maybe a third, forming a coterie that would travel the globe and administer the introduction of plants. Two would search full-time, and the third, the three might rotate, would remain in Washington to receive cuttings. They fancied their title as Agricultural Explorer, a term so whimsical, so obvious, that it came out of their mouths at the same time. The brainstorming was based less on youthful naivete than on a thoughtful budgeting of time, money, and human energy. They drafted a memo that alternated each man's handwriting, and they devised a hierarchy. The program would need structure. Both men understood how the world worked and knew the value of being sponsored by a government as powerful as America's. Rather than just send someone to travel aimlessly, they would make decisions based on fact, not merely hope. As botanists, they debated which families of crops would be the easiest to transport, and which could produce new crops the fastest. One night, Swingle sat reading about Egypt. "My God," he said, "it takes date palms 15 years to bear fruit. If this book tells the truth, we'll be old before we get anywhere in the date business." Fairchild, without looking up, responded that the book was wrong. On the evening of July 3, 1898, the street below Fairchild and Swingle's window filled with a raucous crowd. Newsboys yelled, "Extra Star!" hawking late-run broadsheets that reported the Battle of Santiago de Cuba, a naval clash just off the south coast of Florida. On that very day, the eve of the anniversary of America's independence, the United States locked horns with a different colonizing superpower, Spain. 4 centuries earlier, Christopher Columbus had claimed Cuba for the Spanish monarchy, which would eventually build an empire from the Colorado River to Tierra del Fuego. But gradually, the land was dismantled piece by piece until Cuba and Puerto Rico were the only Western Hemisphere possessions Spain had left. Now Cuba wanted independence. America was sympathetic to a colonized people hungry for liberty. Americans had sided with the Cubans with surprising unity, not least because helping the island offered a chance to neutralize a Spanish perch so close to American shores. The conflict was the first major opportunity for America, not far past its 100th birthday, to fight a long-standing bull of global dominance. If there was debate about the conflict, journalists didn't spend much time covering dissent. The Chicago Tribune included in each day's newspaper an above-the-fold etching of the American flag and the slogan, "One flag, one cause, one country." Even William Jennings Bryan, the man who lost the 1896 election on a platform of avoiding international skirmishes, supported the cause of Cuba Libre with such enthusiasm that he publicly told President William McKinley, the man who had beat him, "I hereby place my services at your command." More than freeing a colonized people, politicians also knew that siding with the Cuban insurrection would help protect trade routes for valuable commodities such as sugar and tobacco. To flex its muscle in Cuba, the United States ordered the construction of a great battleship, the USS Maine. America's shipbuilding prowess fell far short of Spain's, so the top-heavy and poorly armed Maine was no match for vessels in the Spanish fleet. But that turned out not to matter. Its purpose in Cuba was to beef up America's image, effectively a pair of shoulder pads for the scrawny United States Navy. Yet not long after it left Key West in January of 1898, when the ship exploded with a window-breaking boom and sank to the bottom of the Havana Harbor, it became a different kind of symbol. What came next was one of the clearest examples of America's growing ingenuity, particularly the formation of the long-standing ethos that there was always money to be made, especially amid crisis. The journalism barons William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, locked in battle to outsell each other's New York newspapers, used the public frenzy for war, which each man's paper inflamed, to sell more papers. Both the New York World and the New York Journal ran banner headlines above breathless reports of the fighting in Cuba, containing every detail except Spain's flat denial that it was responsible for the main explosion, a claim modern forensics have mostly held up. The hysteria made its way to Congress, which voted 311-6 to declare war on Spain, along with an allocation of $50 million for President McKinley to spend how he pleased. Whether the war was warranted, or arrived at honestly, turned out to be irrelevant. Hearst would go on to serve in Congress. Pulitzer's name became shorthand for superb journalism. Everyone in Washington was wrapped up in the war, America's biggest foreign conflict since its 1848 duel with Mexico. Politicians were at the same time delighted at the prospect of a fight. One American diplomat called it a splendid little war, and also wary at what they had started. Members of Congress worried they'd be foolish to send too many soldiers to Cuba, leaving Washington unguarded in case a Spanish warship sailed up the Potomac. In the days before radar, sonar, or reliable spatial monitoring, a surprise attack of this sort would have ended the war, and America not long after. Fairchild seemed to be everywhere his fraught country needed him. After months of unemployment, he signed up to mine the Potomac with remote-activated bombs in case the Spanish invaded. He partnered with Frank Hitchcock, who would later become chairman of the Republican National Committee and ultimately Postmaster General, and the two rode around the river, stopping every few feet to drop a bomb and then activate it with a small wire that, when triggered, would blow apart the hull of a Spanish ship. Hitchcock struck Fairchild as feather-brained and clumsy, which worried him every time he connected the wiring to a bomb. Hitchcock always seemed to be the one holding the battery pack some distance away, and not the one at risk of being blown to the clouds. The Spanish never came to Washington. After the Maine explosion, Spanish officials tried to bypass America's overheating temper and sent a fleet directly to Cuba. When it got there, U.S. Navy ships blockaded Spain's incursion. On land, a volunteer horseback cavalry called the Rough Riders, led by 40-year-old Teddy Roosevelt, waged battle. The combination of land and sea warfare was a show of newfound American strength. So much that within days, much of Spain's fleet was either badly damaged or sitting underwater. When Spain conceded defeat, after just 113 days, the United States, a nation on the rise, had for the first time eclipsed one of the world's top powers. Men like Hearst and Pulitzer, who had benefited from swells in newspaper sales, took the occasion to declare America an emerging force in its own right. They gloated that in just over a century, America had gone from mistreated colony to a nation of great confidence, military clout, and moral superiority. The U.S. victory also turned out to be a victory for food. American soldiers had been sent to Cuba with rations of canned beef, a foodstuff so sordid and foul that after the war, Congress investigated why so many soldiers got sick. Sick soldiers might have lost the war for the United States, if not for the way they supplemented their diet with tropical fruits they picked up in Cuba. Soldiers marveled at new types of bananas, juicy limes and pineapples, and strange specimens many soldiers had never seen, such as the yellow carambola, also known as starfruit, with five perfectly symmetrical ridges. In a way, fruit had given America its edge in victory. And when soldiers returned, stories of these novelties awakened the American public, its palate stimulated by the diversity of new things obtainable in the tropics. Secretary of Agriculture James Wilson was a tall, thin man whose gray beard, deep-set eyes, and receding hairline suggested constant concern over large matters. Behind his old desk made of knotted oak with carvings of flowers and vines, he peered through wire spectacles at the three men who sat before him. Accompanying Fairchild and Swingle was Dr. A. C. True, head of the experiment stations and Fairchild's former boss at the department, who the young botanist hoped would add credibility to the request he was about to make. James Wilson was a savvy man of politics, who, owing to his character and shrewdness, had been President McKinley's choice to head the Department of Agriculture. A Scotsman, Wilson had emigrated to Iowa in 1852 in hopes of farming in a country that was economically ascendant. He hadn't sought out higher office. He was drafted by a neighbor who appreciated the way Wilson spoke, peppering his speech with biblical allusions. Wilson had built one of the strangest resumes in American history. He won a seat in Congress in 1882, was sworn into office, then learned after a recount that he had actually lost the election. Defiant, he used parliamentary procedures for 2 years to silence the other party's objection to his legitimacy. Then, with just minutes left in the congressional term, he resigned his seat to his opponent. In Wilson's wood-paneled office at 1400 Independence Avenue, just steps from the Washington Monument, Fairchild explained that since the USDA was formed in 1862, its primary role had been to dispense seeds. But by 1898, the Congressional Seed Program struck many people, farmers included, as laughable graft, a Gilded Age boondoggle that benefited politicians and no one else. It wasn't uncommon for packets specifying round pansies to yield horn-shaped foxgloves, and purple petunias came up looking like pink hollyhocks. When the packets were accurately marked, farmers were happy to take free seeds of corn and potatoes, but they didn't need them. The program, with an annual budget of $200,000, amounted to an entitlement relic from an era when farmers were starting their businesses, not expanding them. But now, farmers had a different kind of need. As fertile land was opening in the West and South, settlers were appealing almost daily, less for the Department of Agriculture's money than for its wisdom on what crops could be grown and how to fight pests. Fairchild had heard stories of farmers in the upper Mississippi Valley who wanted hardier plants than the apples of the eastern states. Settlers in the Southwest needed drought-resistant plants and help with irrigation. Fairchild argued to Wilson that the answers weren't inside the Department of Agriculture. They were across the oceans in places like China and Egypt, where people had learned over millennia to farm in tough conditions. Fairchild told Wilson of his association with Barbara Lathrop and of their attempts to introduce plants. He had become accustomed to describing the flavor of the wampi and the durian and the mangosteen, each enticing, worthwhile, and completely unknown in the United States. But beyond his personal tastes, wasn't it strange, Fairchild observed, man's propensity to be satisfied with so little when so much was available? Fairchild wrote a lengthy memo to organize his thoughts. To the most casual observer, it must be apparent that the number of useful plants, compared with those of which man makes no use, is very small. The menu of an average American dinner includes the product of scarcely a dozen plants, and yet the number which could be grown for the table would reach into the hundreds. There are several reasons why the number of plants upon which we depend for subsistence remains small, and the competition between producers of the same plant product continues fierce, but the most potent one lies in a persistent conservatism of taste, which is both unreasoning and uncontrollable. That the German peasant should look on Indian cornmeal as fit only for his livestock, or the inhabitants of some portions of Holland consider the sheep raised along their canals for the English market in the same light as Americans do horse flesh, are facts which must be reckoned with, however unreasonable they may appear, in any attempts at plant introduction. Fairchild wasn't bold enough to think he could change human nature, but there was reason to believe Americans were more susceptible to expanding their palates than were people in other countries. As a symptom of its youth, he argued, the United States was impressionable. Stretching some 3,000 miles from coast to coast, from the cold winters of upland Maine to the sweltering summers along the Rio Grande, the United States enjoyed more climatic diversity than anywhere else on the planet. What if the department started a pilot program to learn about those other crops? Fairchild asked. If it failed, the program could be killed. But if it worked, the benefits to American food could be infinite. Fairchild wasn't asking to travel. He was suggesting that he run such a program from Washington. Swingle could go to Europe, and perhaps, he argued, they could fund the travels of another man, too. The whole operation could get by with a few thousand dollars and a little office space. Fairchild had even thought of a name.